Hello and welcome to the Health Hacks Podcast, the podcast for high-performing professional females looking for practical ways to optimize all areas of their health and wellness. At Health Hacks, we understand that as a busy female, you wear numerous hats throughout your working week. You're trying to juggle it all, while also looking to carve out time to prioritize your own goals. It's challenging. It's therefore our mission to channel your energy into the areas that are going to help give you the biggest bang for your buck, to really make significant changes to your lifestyle in the most efficient way possible. So at the moment, if you feel as though you need more energy, you want to feel more productive to improve the quality of your sleep, to lower stress, to increase confidence, to show up better in both your personal and your professional relationships, this podcast is for you. If it's time you prioritize your health, learn to fuel your body, found time for exercise, and said goodbye to fad diets and inconsistent behaviors for good, this podcast is for you. If it's time for you to step into the shoes of the high performer you know you can be, this is the right podcast for you. Join me and my guests as we take you through the Health Hacks Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Health Hacks Podcast, where this week we are joined by Emma Murphy. Emma is a disordered eating and binge eating specialist. She is the founder of Eating Freely, a program that was developed over 12 years ago, working with adults in this area. Emma was working with disordered eating in 2009 before binge eating disorder was even identified as a serious condition. We know that it affects millions of adults worldwide, and we're really, really fortunate to have Emma on the podcast today. Expect to learn the personality traits that are common in those who find themselves either emotional or binge eating. What is the difference between emotional and binge eating? And is there such a thing as healthy emotional eating? All coming up in today's episode. If you love the work we do on Health Hacks and you would love to show your support for the podcast, I would sincerely appreciate it. But there are two ways to do that. If you're listening to me on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, simply scroll down onto the podcast platform and hit the follow or subscribe button, depending on which platform you're using, and your episode of Health Hacks will be delivered to your app every single Tuesday. You'll never need to search for us again. Or perhaps there is someone in your life who struggles with emotional eating. Maybe they've brought it up with you over a coffee or on a walk or on your last phone conversation. If you found the information that we put out on Health Hacks useful, perhaps they will too. Send them this episode or send them the show and they can scroll through our back catalogue, whether it is emotional eating or whether it's family-friendly nutrition or perimenopause or time confidence. Maybe there is a topic that we've covered that will really help them out too. The more women that we can help globally, the more we can spread our message around positive health and well-being practices, the better. Without further ado, let's go into this episode with the wonderful Emma Murphy. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Health Hacks Podcast. Today I'm thrilled to be joined by Emma Murphy. Emma is a disordered eating specialist and CEO of Eating Freely, the world's leading network of emotional and binge eating specialists. Emma has spent the last 12 years working with hundreds of clients globally, providing expert, evidence-based support to help adults fully recover from emotional eating and binge eating disorders. She joins us today. Hi, Emma. How are you?
Hi, Caroline. Great to be here. I'm very well, thank you.
We're absolutely thrilled to have you. Emma, huge topic to be covering today. But before we do so, let's find out a little bit more about you, how you arrived to where you are today and the work that you do. And if you could run us through Eating Freely and your mission.
Okay. So I'm 55, and on the day after my 30th birthday, I walked out of work during my lunch break and went down and signed up for a four-year degree in psychology. I was having that existential crisis of going into your 30s and what am I doing with my life? And I had been volunteering with the Rape Crisis Centre for a year at that stage, and I had found it really rewarding and fulfilling. And I was working in small business development in the Chambers of Commerce at the time, and I really wasn't, it just wasn't doing it for me anymore. You know, I kind of drifted. I've had a lot of different jobs. But I just working with the Rape Crisis Centre really spoke to me and just helping people and, you know, going into that area. So I signed up for the degree in psychology that September and went back to school. And from the moment I went back, I was just drawn to the area of eating disorders. I was writing essays on it. I was doing projects on it, you know, all of that stuff. And I didn't really know why, because I have never suffered with an eating disorder myself. Now, I had had a friend, a very close friend of mine, who had a very bad eating disorder when we were teenagers. I also worked in the airline industry, and we saw a lot of eating disorders there in the crew. And that was back at the time where you had to be a certain weight for your height. And, you know, there was actually quite strict rules around your physical appearance in the airline industry. So you can appreciate that promoted a lot of disordered eating. But I'd never struggled myself. And it was years later, after I became an eating disorder professional, an expert working in that area, I was sitting in supervision one day and having, again, some kind of an existential moment with my supervisor. And I said, I don't even know why I work in this area. I mean, what am I even doing here? Like, why me? And I really feel that there's a bit of a vocation piece to it. And he said, Emma, you get the clients you need. You are your clients. And I was like, what? I share the personality type of almost every client that we see who has an eating disorder. There's a particular personality type. There's a set of circumstances. There's a framework within which a lot of clients have lived, you know, a life framework or trajectory that a client has lived through with a certain personality type, which together can very often tip somebody into developing an eating disorder. And I share that same personality type, and I shared some of those life experiences. I just never turned to food as my coping strategy. Once I understood that, it was really empowering, because anything I did for myself to help myself operate better in the world. And of course, that I was doing a lot of that because I was a therapist and ongoing personal and professional development. I was able to bring a lot of that into the program, into my work with clients, you know, and as I learned how to do very important things like take better care of myself, move from my head to my heart, let go of perfectionism, let go of busy work, let go of all sorts of things that I struggled with. I was able to bring those things into my work with the clients and develop the program. So the Eating Freely program developed out of me working in private practice with eating disorders almost exclusively for 12 years. And whilst I would have worked with people on every part of the spectrum, the majority of clients were in the emotional eating and binge eating section in the middle. And over 12 years of working with clients, sharing tools with them, sharing strategies, going off and doing my own personal work, bringing my own learning back in, you know, sharing that stuff, that's how the eating program, the Eating Freely program, evolved and was finally conceptualized. It was a combination of my personal experience and my professional experience of working with hundreds and hundreds of clients online, in person, one-to-one, in groups, workshops, you name it, I did it. And that's where our program came from. And in 2017, I was getting a bit burnt out. I was really busy. It's not a popular area for practitioners to want to work in, particularly for therapists. Eating disorders, you know, it's just not seen as being very sexy, unfortunately. And actually, it's a fascinating area to work in. I trained two of my colleagues to use my program because I needed somebody to refer clients to because I had a waiting list. And that's how I started training other practitioners in my program. And now, you know, 7 years later, we have Eating Freely practitioners in 10 countries. We are training and licensing practitioners all over the world. And they're able to go out and help clients. And because of the way I've done it, we're able to help a lot more clients than I could ever help just sitting here in the chair in front of one client at a time or in front of one group at a time.
Of course. It really surprises me that it's not, you mentioned it wasn't as it was an unsexy area, but it affects so many people. I'm really surprised that it isn't something that is explored more by therapists. Emma, I'll be absolutely shocked, or the audience will be screaming at me to ask. You mentioned there were frameworks and personalities or personality types that lend themselves. I'm going to have to ask, what are the recurring themes that you see are personality types?
For sure. So we are, to a man and woman, perfectionistic, high achieving, all or nothing thinkers, very black or white thinking. We're either doing it all right or all wrong. And that is one of the biggest saboteurs for clients who emotionally eat or binge eat, because, you know, I'll start again on Monday. I'm back on track. I'm on my plan. But the minute There's a biscuit or a cookie or a bun or, you know, a bad choice instead of the healthy choice. That's it. It's game over. And that client can go into a day, a week, a month of emotional binge eating. So there's that very polarized all or nothing thinking. And it is one of the biggest saboteurs for clients because we try and walk them back from that idea of like from 100 to collapse. And we actually use the phrase lapse, relapse, and collapse. And if you can reframe it as a lapse and get back on track and move on, that very same day after that one episode, you can get back on track. That's one of the biggest game changers. And that's something that we start working on straight away. In terms of life experience, clients are very often the eldest child or the eldest daughter. They take on inappropriate responsibility at a young age. There is usually a trauma or a life, an adverse life experience that has happened in the family. Here in Ireland, for example, and I always speak about cultural, context, but here in Ireland, the top five sort of experiences that our clients will have routinely grown up with would have been a parent who was an alcoholic, a parent who had a chronic mental illness, diagnosed or undiagnosed. Remember, I'm 55, so and a lot of our clients actually, and this may surprise people. The majority of my clients certainly were between the age of 40 and 60. So they have struggled for decades, having had a childhood experience of alcoholism, a parent who was diagnosed or undiagnosed mental illness, any form of abuse, obviously. And unfortunately, in Ireland, we have a very shameful history of abuse, sexual abuse, but emotional, mental, physical, or sexual abuse, any form of abuse, bullying. And again, people might think that that's bullying because of weight. Not often, not always. Sometimes it was, but quite often it was actually about being poor or about, you know, the family circumstances. So your dad's the local drunk, or, you know, you can't afford shoes, you know, those kind of things. And the fifth one is, I think, quite culturally contextual. So again, growing up in Ireland, when I was sitting in my classroom in primary school in the 70s, I was surrounded by kids who had 7, 11, 15 brothers and sisters, because contraception was illegal in Ireland up until the middle of the 1980s. And not a lot of people know that. So, Catholic families, you know, the mums were having a baby a year, a baby every 18 months, you know. So there were huge families. And two things happened in that context. Our eldest child was expected to take on inappropriate responsibility for younger children. They may also have been expected to step in as a substitute spouse to a parent if the other parent was emotionally absent through, again, the mental illness, the alcoholism, whatever it was. And quite often there had been a death in the family of one or more children, because, again, inoculations, vaccinations, you know, health issues that we had back then that we don't have today, and just so many children and living in poverty and, you know, all sorts of different factors. But the large family just meant that there was a higher chance of one or more children actually dying. And so a lot of clients would have had a sibling that died when they were younger. And so if a child dies, parents are emotionally absent, but there's other children to be looked after. So our client has to step up and step in. And then they don't want to burden their mom or dad with their own problems. So they learned how to turn to food for emotional regulation or as their self-soothing strategy.
Understood. So there is a really complex backstory, or it's much deeper rooted than simply making ourselves feel better
Oh,
or.
that's the whole thing. Yeah, people, emotional eating sounds like, you know, we all emotionally eat. Everybody eats for emotional reasons. But to actually struggle with long-standing emotional eating or binge eating disorder, it's almost always underpinned by trauma. And then, so the trauma is really important. That's a very common factor that somebody has gone through some kind of traumatic or adverse experience, usually at a young age. And then tie into that the personality type, which, as I've mentioned, we've got our all or nothing perfectionistic, high achieving, you know, thinker, black and white. Very hard to find it very difficult to ask for what they want and need. They put everybody else's needs ahead of themselves. Remember, that might have come from the family context where they were expected to know how to take the emotional temperature, you know, or put their own needs behind that of their mom who was ill or their dad who was a drinker and maybe would get violent if everyone didn't just keep the peace and you know say nothing. So we talk about that people pleaser personality trait, and again, that's a everyone understands that. But that also goes much deeper. That was something that they were almost trained to do or groomed into as a result of maybe the context that they grew up in, you know. So it's very hardwired, and it takes a lot of work to unpack all of that. Very poor self-care. Again, no more than putting everybody else ahead of themselves. They find it very difficult to authentically take care of themselves. And again, depending on the trauma and the experience, there's often sometimes actual self-neglect there, unconsciously, like neglecting themselves. We've all had that client, or we've all known somebody who will buy all the supplements and then leave them in the cupboard and not take them, or buy all the healthy food and then leave it in the fridge until it all goes off and then it gets thrown in the bin. But like, that's actually a client literally not able to show themselves enough self-care and self-compassion to actually feed themselves properly or look after themselves well. Our clients will often be that the strong one in the group, the strong one in the family, the one that everybody turns to. And again, you know, not able to appear vulnerable, or you know, not able to appear weak, so they will never ask other people for help. And we also have we also see that clients being very cognitive and heady, so in their head. And so they try and logic and rationalize their way out of everything. It's all mental, thinky, thinky. So they're not at all connected with their heart or with their gut. And they find it very hard to trust their own gut and make decisions for themselves. So they can actually be very indecisive, because they don't trust their gut. And they'll often look outside of them for, you know, social proof or validation of a decision that they're going to make before they'll make it themselves. You know, very, very difficult for them to make decisions. Yet they could be doing very well in work and performing quite well, and on the outside look to everybody as if they're, you know, they've got it all going on and they're winning at life, you know. And yet, as Brené Brown says, they are like a tortoise in a briar patch with no shell on. They're very, very sensitive and vulnerable on the inside, but wear a very good mask to hide that from anybody else in their lives. So they would be almost uniformly common factors and traits that we would see in the majority of clients.
And I'm sorry I have to say this, Emma, but I'm sure many people are listening to this feeling as though they feel very seen right now, as though what you've just described, it hits hard and it hits home because they think, that's me. You've just articulated thoughts I've had within my own head. And I notice those patterns of behavior or those thoughts within myself, or I see that that's how my relationships are with others. I think a lot of ladies listening to this will feel seen by what you've just described. In the interests of setting the context of our conversation, I would love it if we could define the difference or the similarities, if it's easier to do it that way, between emotional eating and binge eating. Because I know we use these terms, but I wonder from your perspective if you could shed some light on what they actually mean.
So emotional eating, you know, obviously emotional eating on the surface, we can understand it is eating in response to a feeling or emotion that we have. And, you know, we all eat for emotional reasons, and we actually, it's built into culture. You know, we eat when we're happy, we eat when we're sad, we eat when we're celebrating, we eat when we're commiserating, you know, the Irish funeral, you know, it's a food and drink fest. You know, that's something that we all do culturally. Food is a very central part of our social experience. And we all know that, you know, oh, I've had a stressful day. I'm, you know, going to treat myself to, you know, a bottle of wine and a family sized bag of crisps or whatever. And we might know that we're doing that. So emotional eating, in eating in response to emotions, usually you know that you're doing it, and you know that that's what you do. Now, that doesn't mean to say that it's always adaptive or helpful. So I like to kind of put a little differentiation in there, where if you're doing it mindfully, so you know you're doing it and you're doing it, but then it stops and then you move on and it doesn't happen again for a while, that's okay. Some people then would, you know, eat in response to everything. I hear clients saying this: I eat when I'm happy, I'm eating when I'm sad, I'm eating when I'm angry. You know, that's less helpful. You know, that's where there's an autopilot in the brain that has been kicked in, you know, where the client is responding to a lot of different feelings and emotions with food. So there needs to be some support and help around managing their emotions better, or reacting them to it, responding to them mindfully in a different way, as opposed to reacting to them, you know, by eating. Binge eating disorder is a classified eating disorder in the DSM-5. So it came in to the DSM-5 around 10 years ago. It wasn't a discrete eating disorder before then. So it's been around for 10 years now as a diagnosis, but still very misunderstood, underdiagnosed, and undertreated. Anyone going into the doctor and talking about their health, and the doctor won't ask about the relationship with food. If they say that they're overeating or emotional eating, they're usually like, I've so many clients have told me, my doctor told me to go to Weight Watchers, for example. Do you know, they're told to go on a diet, eat less, move more. And of course, that has got nothing to do with binge eating disorder. Binge eating disorder is where a client, this is really where the client is likely to have had that quite, significant traumatic experience and learned to self-soothe or self-regulate with food. And really what they're doing is they're eating far more quickly than normal, eating way past the point of physical hunger, eating when they're not physically hungry for food, eating in secret, night eating, all of those kind of behaviors. And there's two key diagnostic criteria that fit with binge eating disorder that are very important to understand. The first one is that it feels like an out-of-body experience. The client literally does not feel in control of the episode while it's happening. And clients will often say, it's like I'm standing outside of myself. It's like I suddenly realize I'm doing it. I don't even know how I got there. So that's something that we hear very commonly. And then the other one is afterwards, the clients experience significant and very difficult emotions of guilt, shame, disgust, and anger and hatred of themselves, like very strong emotions. So that's a world away from me sitting down after a stressful Tuesday and saying, I'm going to have three glasses of wine and a family-sized bag of chips all to myself tonight because I just had a rubbish day and this is how I'm going to treat myself. Because I know I'm doing it. I'll throw away the bottle, throw away the bag, go to bed, I'll be fine, and it won't happen again for a couple of months. That's normal emotional eating. That's a world away from a client who's self-regulating, whose brain is in hypervigilance, who's engaging in a safety behavior that is counteracting or has developed over time to counteract the difficult feelings and emotions that come up, which are very often like rooted in the past. So a lot of clients who have experienced a trauma just generally feel very shamed an awful lot of the time. It's like a white noise that's just running in the background all the time. And their whole self-concept, their self-worth is tied up with that memory. So the Eating Freely program is designed to do two things, primarily. It separates the client's food from their feelings. So we separate food out from the feelings and slowly build up a toolkit of other things that clients can do when they are triggered. And also learn how to manage those feelings and emotions, more appropriately. But we really have to also separate the past from the present, because if we don't remove those deep-rooted unconscious triggers, the client can't move on. And no amount of eat less, move more is going to, sort that out.
I'm going to interrupt this episode of Health Hacks for under a minute to say if this topic that we're covering today on emotional and binge eating has resonated strongly with you. If you feel this is an area that you would benefit from one-to-one support in, get in touch with us, either myself or Emma. I've put all of our links in the show notes below. There's a link to my personal diary where you can book a discovery call. If you feel that emotional eating is something that has been part of your life for what feels like forever, maybe you can't imagine a time where your relationship with food was something that you wanted to change. Maybe you would love to feel more relaxed around food. Maybe you feel that evening snacking is the thing holding you back. Maybe for you it is emotional eating around stressful situations. Maybe for you it's eating at certain times of the month, whatever that may be. If you'd like to make a positive change once and for all, get in touch, book a discovery call. I'd love to find out more about you and your goals for this upcoming year. You can find the link to my personal calendar in the show notes below, and we can discuss one-to-one coaching with myself or a member of my team. For now, let's get back to this week's episode. Well, you mentioned there, I was going to ask you kind of the three instances you described there, would I be right in saying they almost work on a spectrum? So someone will find that they fall somewhere on that spectrum. Is that correct?
Absolutely, 100%. And we don't do diagnosis. So I'm really glad you said that, Caroline, because it is on a spectrum. And sometimes, you know, you're up at one end, sometimes you're at the other end. Some clients are in, you know, the deep end all of the time, and you can move in and out of it as well. So we don't find it particularly helpful to try and put somebody on a scale of where are you on your emotional eating scale. As far as we're concerned, if you're in distress about your relationship with food and you know that there's an emotional component to it, that's good enough for us, and we will help you. It's not necessarily helpful for people to get a diagnosis or to be told that they have an eating disorder, binge. In fact, a lot of clients would be horrified if you actually said eating disorder to them. You know, that's because when we say eating disorder, what do you think of? You think of anorexia, you think of a young, skinny girl, and that's only 1 out of 10 eating disorder sufferers. The other 9 out of 10 are on the overeating part of the spectrum. But because it's still so misunderstood and unknown about, you know, it's not necessarily always helpful to give people that label, or to pathologize it by, you know, giving it a mental health diagnosis, which is what it actually is. So we actually tend to use the phrase emotional eating most of the time in our general communication, because that makes it easy for clients to maybe reach out and ask for help. If we only ever spoke about eating disorder and binge eating disorder, we would miss so many people who don't self-identify as belonging in that category, and they'd glaze over looking at our website and they'd move on.
Emma, is there any kind of healthy emotional eating? So you said, you painted a picture of a scenario I think we can all relate to where we've had a really, really hectic day. Maybe something awful has happened at work. You know, when you open up your email and there's just 100 fires to put out and you think, my goodness, how did I get to the end of this Wednesday? Where's the wine, as you say, and the big bar of chocolate? You said if that's happening once in a while, as in maybe once every few months, is that what we would call normal? Is that atypical? Is that a healthy relationship with food? Or is any kind of overindulgence or extreme behavior, should we be worried about any of that?
No. And that's another thing that I find so unhelpful about, look, I'm not going to talk about the diet industry as in talking about the diet industry and my, you know, feelings about that. But that is one thing that we find spectacularly unhelpful, is that everybody has this idea and this all or nothing thinking, Caroline, where, you know, I'm either doing it all right or all wrong. And that's not true. I can eat 3 really good, balanced, healthy meals today and have a cup of tea and a shortbread biscuit, which I did at 11 o'clock this morning. And then I might actually go downstairs and sit in front of the TV for the evening and eat nothing, and that's absolutely fine. Equally, I might be sitting there and thinking, do you know what? Wouldn't mind a bag of crisps, and I might have a bag of crisps. Or I might say, do you know what? That was a horrible day, and I'll have a bottle of wine and, you know, a bag of crisps. I suppose the difference is when you know that you're doing it, or as I might do, I might sit there and kind of ask myself, okay, like, what's really going on here? You know, why am I, you know, maybe why is this the third night that I feel like I want to open another bottle of wine and have a bag of crisps? I'm exaggerating slightly, but the menopause has put paid to But if, you know, it's learning that skill of being able to ask yourself why. Like, why have I spent the last week eating everything in sight? You know, why have I not been able to take my head out of the fridge? You know.
Ask yourself if you're tired is always the one. If I want to reach for something at the end of the day, it's generally a fatigue is coming from somewhere, for me
Yeah,
anyway.
I mean, and fatigue is a huge one. You know, obviously we're all extremely busy, and, you know, again, the menopause, you know, that obviously plays havoc with people's sleep also, and there's all sorts of reasons why our sleep might be poor. And we often find as well the clients who emotionally eat or binge eat, their sleep would be very poor actually. So even though clients might say, I crash out, yes, you do, because you had a sugar high, then you had a sugar crash, then you crashed, but your sleep isn't restorative. Your body's actually really busy doing stuff that it's not meant to be doing when you're asleep, because it's trying to break down all the food that you just ate. And so you wake up in the morning. So our question is always, but how do you feel when you wake up in the morning? Do you feel refreshed and reinvigorated and ready to go? Oh no, like I have brain fog and I can't move until I've had 4 cups of coffee, you know, and that kind of thing. So it's about checking in and asking yourself, why am I doing this? And being able to really link the two things, because if you're emotionally eating, what you're doing is you're numbing out. You're distracting yourself from something else. You're numbing out. You're trying to avoid it. So we sometimes say that you're either. So where do you feel a feeling? If you feel happy, you know, you'll feel a warmth in your chest, you'll feel relaxed, you'll feel your muscles sort of, you'll loosen out, and you'll feel quite expansive and sort of, you know, chill and loose. So we feel it in our body. You know, it's not just that we have this thought, oh, I am happy. It's like, I feel happy, and I literally feel happy in my body. Equally, when you feel angry, so say you've had a run-in with your boss, or you have a, you know, particularly nasty person in the social group who's, you know, had a go at you that morning or whatever it is, and you come home, and how are you feeling? Well, then you're feeling tense, and maybe your tummy's a little bit upset, and, you know, you're kind of clenching your jaw, and you might have a headache. And clients who don't really know how to process their emotions or deal with a situation like that. So we find a lot of clients struggle really with anger is one of the biggest emotions that we do a lot of work with. If you are not assertive enough to be able to stand up to that person, say, don't speak to me like that, or, you know, I don't accept what you're saying, and, you know, have that good boundary, the client will leave feeling, you know, all agitated and, you know, kind of caught up in their body. And we often say that, you know, emotion eating is literally trying to stuff that feeling back down again, to literally stop the body from having that physical reaction, you know. And if somebody is bulimic and they're purging by vomiting, they're literally trying to eject that feeling out of their body. Like, because we feel so much of our emotions in our body as well. It's partly physical and it's partly emotional. So we have to separate the food from the feelings, but we also have to equip the client with the tools that they need to be able to go to the boss or the, you know, nasty person in the group and say, you know, the way you treat me is not okay. So we talk about the ABC, the assertiveness, boundaries, and communication model. So, you know, giving people those tools that they need to be able to ask for what they want and need and say no to what they don't want and don't need. So in that, we're coming back to maybe that people-pleasing piece or that, you know, fear, and that fear can go back a long way. If you grew up in a house where somebody was violent and unpredictable, you're going to find it very difficult to stand up to a bully when you don't know what the reaction is going to be.
Mm-hmm. And I find this relationship with food really interesting in that it's such a, it almost feels like a safety net a lot of the time. So I liked what you said about we want to push those feelings down and we use food as that soother or that comforter. But I find that relationship really interesting in that it has this soothing effect, and yet other times it's the complete opposite. And we almost have this fear of food. And again, it's this extreme mentality, isn't it? It's this all or nothing. It's food is my friend and my comforter, or food is the enemy. I must run and hide. Don't even look at the cakes when I go and get coffee in the morning. Is that something that a lot of your clients would describe or experience?
Absolutely. And I remember one client in particular, I think we have a quote for on our website, which is, you know, I honestly never considered food as something that was necessary to life. I considered food as my enemy. But we have to eat. So how can you have food as an enemy? How can food be something that you're afraid of when you literally have to eat it, you know, 2 to 3 times a day at a minimum? You know, it's ridiculous. And we often find that clients as well have this magical thinking, as I call it, where, well, I just won't buy food and I won't have it in the house. And then I won't eat it, and then I lose the weight, and then I'll start eating it again, you know. But of course, that never works because your body's not going to accept that. But our relationship with food has become so complicated and so overcomplicated, not only for people who actually have been using it. And there is a very strong safety component to this, Caroline. So that's the unconscious. That's the child who learned how to self-soothe and self-regulate with food. You know, that unconscious trigger kicks in, you know, 100 times faster than your conscious brain. So that's why people think, you know, I have no willpower, but that's not correct. You have plenty of willpower, but your brain is far stronger than you. And if it thinks that it's been threatened, it's going to override your conscious will to not have that cake. And it's going to make you eat that cake because that's what makes the brain feel safe in the moment. But in terms of like being afraid of food, that's something that we have to completely renegotiate with clients and help them understand that like food is fuel, food is necessary, and quite a lot of the time, food is medicine, you know, so you can actually use it to promote better health and wellness within yourself. But it can be very complex, you know, and we do have clients who would restrict a lot. So like really eating very little and only eating very small range of what they would consider to be safe foods. So if I was doing a food diary with somebody, and not every client likes the food diary either. So, you know, please, any well health coaches out there listening, don't do food diaries with everybody because, you know, it's a case by case basis. But if you were doing a food diary with somebody and you could see like for a week, same breakfast, same lunch, and broadly the same dinner, that's somebody who's afraid of food. But then, so, and they might be under eating. I can look at a food diary and go, well, that client's about a good 400 calories off what they should be eating every day. But they'll also be binging at night, and the binging foods, of course, will be completely unhealthy and completely different.
I'm thinking of quite a lot of our ladies will come to us, and there will be a component of weight loss involved in their goals. Now, whether that weight loss is a life-changing amount of weight for health reasons, whether that weight loss is a couple of pounds just to feel more comfortable in their jeans, whether that weight loss is actually more, I want to feel more toned, so athletic, I want to build some lean muscle tissue. There can be any variation between those on that scale. But there are generally some body composition changes that are tied in with the goals. Mm-hmm. If someone wants to drop weight, so drop body fat, but they don't have a great relationship with food, do you have any recommendations there? Is it, do you suggest ladies don't think or look at weight, or do you fix the relationship with food then think about the weight loss? If you're significantly overweight in an unhealthy way, do you fix your relationship with food? What is your guidance there?
Great question. If you have an unhelpful relationship with food, no diet our weight loss program is going to help. So if you're working your way through the Eating Freely program, there's no focus on weight loss whatsoever. It has to be put completely outside the door for the time that you're doing the program, because actually, if you don't do the inner work first, you're never going to see what you want to see on the outside. It's that simple. So our program is built on three sort of pillars, the three F's, as we say, which are feed yourself properly, forgive yourself quickly, and focus on health and well-being, not weight loss as the goal. And feed yourself properly can take a long time actually to reach in and of itself, because if a client has a highly dysfunctional relationship with food, if they're restricting and then binging, and often we have clients, by the way, this could be as basic as clients don't know how to cook. So, you know, we could be starting from ground zero with helping people develop a better relationship with natural, you know, unprocessed food. But they may, I have coaches trained with us. I remember one coach telling us she spent 15 minutes in one session on Zoom on her phone showing a client how to chop an onion so that she could teach the client the fundamentals of putting together a couple of simple pasta sauces, because the client didn't know how to chop an onion, which is fine, you know, because that's her reality. That's where she grew up. Maybe her mother didn't know how to cook. Maybe there was no food in the house when she was a child. Maybe she just didn't do home economics in school. Maybe she didn't have a mother. You know, we don't know. It doesn't matter. The point is that you have to meet the clients where they're at. So feed yourself properly. You know, it's very trite. So the three F's, you know, feed yourself properly, forgive yourself quickly, focus on health and well-being. That can take a year in terms of giving the client all of the tools and the supports and resources they need to be able to live by the three F's. And forgiving yourself quickly is another huge one as well, because our clients are very, very hard on themselves, very self-critical, and again, very poor to self-care. So again, and that all or nothing thinking, they're either doing it all right or all wrong. So, you know, there's a big piece of work to be done in there too. And then taking weight loss off the table and looking at health and wellness first. You can't have a healthy relationship with food and your body if you're not truly focused on health and well-being. And if you don't understand the true value of both self-compassion and self-care, and they are a huge part of our program as well. And only when all of that work is done, you can, and if there's still weight to be lost from a health perspective, it's to lose it very slowly and sustainable following a plan for life. There's no short-term or temporary different way of eating in order to lose weight before you go back to another way of eating. We develop an eating plan for life for clients, and that's the end of that as far as we're concerned. We actually just don't do weight loss at all. It's not something we focus on. That's not to say the clients don't lose weight. They do.
I was going to ask the question, as a byproduct, I bet that's inevitable that individuals will lose weight.
I would never use the word inevitable, far from it. Quite often clients will plateau for a long time, or, you know, it'll go up, but we're not focusing on it. We don't want to know. I mean, you know, honestly, if a client tells us their weight or tells us that they weigh themselves and they lost weight, it's as if the words were never spoken. We just don't we can't get involved, we cannot get derailed by weight loss. It's so much of it is about your mindset and how you feel about yourself on the inside. You let go of a lot of the desire to look a certain way or be a certain size when you truly love and care about yourself enough to choose to nourish instead of punish yourself with food.
Yeah. And for a lot of women in particular, that would be a new feeling to actually enjoy being in the body that you're in and actually have that self-respect, right? That would be a new feeling. And it takes time to get used to a new feeling, right?
A lot of time.
Emma, I'm not going to be too specific or ask you for too many specific strategies or tools, because I know these will be the core components of your of eating freely and what you do. However, there's a particular scenario that I'm often asked about, and if a client does reach out, it's usually the day after they have consumed more food, maybe late in the evening than they intended to, or they wanted to, or they were happy to do, and they'll reach out the next morning, and the question will be, you know, how do I reset effectively from this? Or what are the things that I should be focused on today? Or I do feel guilty, or I do feel like I shouldn't have engaged in that behavior. What are some of the strategies that you recommend individuals use the day after, the morning after, the next few days after an event like that?
So obviously, some of the tools and methodologies that we use are about helping the client, first of all, reduce those episodes of emotion binge eating in the first place, you know, that we actually try and empower the client around the food so that, you know, these episodes happen, you know, less frequently. But what we really try and educate clients on is separating out their emotional eating or their binge eating from their normal eating. So one of the things that we find people really struggle with is, you know, if I had an episode the night before, client will wake up and think, well, okay, I'm not going to eat any breakfast, and I only have a really light lunch, and I'll have a very small dinner, and then I'll have compensated for, you know, what I ate the night before. And it doesn't work like that, because the emotion eating or binge eating food, it's very rarely kale or avocado. It's, you know, it's the high processed, you know, it's the highly processed sugar, fat, salt. It's not really of any nutritional value. And so you've overloaded your system with a lot of nutritionally valueless, you know, calories, which your body's working really hard to absorb and digest. And then you're depriving your client or your body of nutritionally dense food the next day to try and compensate for that. And actually, it's really to be able to draw a line under it, see it as a lapse, as I said, instead of a collapse, draw a line under it and move on, which means eating your next planned meal, eat your healthy breakfast, eat your lunch, eat your dinner. The best way to get your body back into balance is to get back on track with your normal healthy eating. And so that is the main thing. And the other thing is for clients to be able to say, of course, when they're working in our program, you know, I'm learning. I cannot expect to stop a behavior that's been going on for 20 or 30 years in, you know, 4 weeks. Every binge episode now is a learning experience. I have tools where I can track back to what happened, what was the trigger, you know, and then I can bring that into my session with my practitioner and we can talk about that. So changing that length, forgiving yourself quickly, you know, so you straight away you're talking about feed yourself properly. So if you had a binge the night before, fine, but you feed yourself properly the next day. And you also forgive yourself quickly and say, that happened. I can learn from it. I can bring it into my session. We can talk about it. And we can move on, and I can know that the next time that triggering episode or person, you know, is in my life, I will be able to respond to it differently.
I'll also piggyback on the back of that. Over exercising the next day is also one we see often in life.
Over exercising is also on a spectrum, but compulsive over exercising with the specific purpose of avoiding weight gain after a binge is actually a form of bulimia. So I would always look at client, you know, if clients are over-exercising a lot and engaged in a lot of very high level exercise, and that, you know, I have to go to the gym for 2 hours every day, I have to go for my run every single night, they're constantly training for marathons, triathlons, they get very, very distressed if they're injured or not able to participate in their sport or their activity, to the extent that they may continue exercising even though they have an injury, that can actually meet the criteria for bulimia, where it's an inappropriate compensatory behavior with this specific goal of avoiding weight gain.
And it creates such an unhealthy relationship with exercise too, which
Correct.
obviously is not.
Exercise should never be used for weight loss. It's not about weight loss.
Absolutely. Emma, your mission with eating freely. Obviously, you have spent all of this time building up these phenomenal coaches globally to create a network and help, presumably by this time, hundreds and thousands of individuals. What is your vision going forward for eating freely?
It's very simple. I want to create the world's leading network of emotional eating and binge eating disorder specialists so that anybody anywhere can access specialist help and support at a level that is accessible to them. So we have everything from a card deck that you can buy on Amazon, the Four Energies of Emotional Eating card deck, right through to working one-to-one with an Eating Freely practitioner for 6 months. So you're talking about from $30 up to $3,000, you know, whatever, and beyond. Anyone anywhere can work with an Eating Freely practitioner. And we have all our practitioners offer services at different levels. And we don't have it fully formed yet, but that's my goal is, you know, I specialized in this area. It took me a long time, as you've heard, to understand why I'm in this area, why I work in this area. And that at that point when I was burnt out and I went to train my two colleagues, I could have walked away from this work. I actually was at the point of I can't do this anymore. I'm overwhelmed. I'm dealing with clients of trauma all the time. It's really difficult, you know, and I certainly wasn't getting paid enough either at the time. And I really had to sit with that for a while and kind of ask myself, well, you know, if I hang up my shingle and go off and do something else, what's going to happen to all of the learning that I have absorbed and internalized over the years and my expertise? And, you know, it's just going to die with me. And I know there aren't enough. There's nowhere near enough practitioners out there who are specialized in this area because practitioners don't like it. And I did want to come back to that, actually. But I said, well, the only way that I could, you know, retire with a clear conscience is to know that I've actually handed on my learning and expertise to other people so that they can go on and carry on and do it and maybe even do it in a different way to the way I did it. But, you know, that I would give them the foundational learning that they need. And you did say something earlier on, or Caroline, you kind of asked me about that in terms of it not being the most, you know, interesting area for people to work in. We find a very high percentage of practitioners who come to train with us have their own lived experience of disordered eating. And so they want to give back, and maybe they went into health coaching or nutritional therapy or therapy because they got help and support, or because they didn't get help or support, you know, during their own experience. But it's, you know, it's a problem that affects millions and millions of people, and binge eating disorder in particular. They reckon as many as one in five people have had at least some brush with emotional eating, binge eating, or disordered eating at some point in their lives. But you could probably say about one in 20 people actually have some form of disordered eating to the extent that they would need professional help. And we do not have anywhere near enough practitioners with the specialist knowledge to help. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to teach as many professionals as I can to help clients who struggle with their relationship with food. And then I will be able to go off around Europe in my camper van with a conscience when the time comes.
And I will ask the question. I've spoken freely on this podcast about my experience. My background was previously in kind of extreme photo shoots and bodybuilding style. Early 20s, you do silly things. And, you know, it's why I do the work that I do now, is to prevent anyone making the same mistakes I did. But I'm obviously, it's wonderful to have this conversation today. And from my perspective, you being so open and sharing what you do, and obviously having this, the resource of eating freely to connect individuals with so many practitioners, is an amazing platform that you have. In some ways, I wish we didn't have the problems that required the practitioner. You know, it's a problem that I and any other, I would hope, responsible health coaches is trying to contribute to solve. Is there something that needs to happen at a societal level, in your opinion, to reduce disordered eating or emotional eating? I would imagine it's on the rise. So more people, you talked about huge numbers there. I imagine that's only set to increase with the availability of cheap ultra processed foods and everything that's on the market. Is there something that needs to happen at a societal level to help bulletproof people, or is this unfortunately inevitable?
So many things need to happen, Caroline, and I certainly don't think they're all going to happen in my lifetime. The availability of cheap ultra processed food that food processors make addictive, you know, and there are addictive components in that, it's hyper palatability in the food. That's a problem, a significant problem, and more so I think in the US than in Europe, is how expensive it is to eat well and eat healthily and eat natural food. Like that's, there's a real problem with healthy food scarcity for people. So that's very difficult, and that's a governmental policy, you know, level change that needs to, that's a huge systemic change that needs to happen. In the education system, my daughter goes to a particular, she goes to the school she goes to, which is an all-girls school, specifically because they taught home economics. And she wanted to be a chef back in the day, where there is a big interest in food in our house generally. And she wanted to be a chef back in the day. So we wanted to make sure she went to a school that did home economics. I would have preferred for her to have gone to a mixed school, but actually home economics isn't a standard subject anymore. It used to be back in my day. So a lot of people, and I mentioned this before, a lot of people can't even cook. So bringing healthy eating and healthy cooking into school at a young age and helping kids to understand that, and just growing up and being able to put together basic healthy meals and understand the basics of nutrition, is another change that could really help. But the one that I, the soapbox that I, and there are areas that other people are fighting for and lobbying for and working on. The one that I advocate for and kind of fight for is within the medical and healthcare space. Up to 40% of people with type 2 diabetes meet the criteria for binge eating disorder, and up to 60% of patients for bariatric surgery meet the criteria. And yet the specialist psychological support needed for that huge percentage of those groups is not there. It's not part of the regular patient pathway. And in fact, it can sometimes disqualify people from treatment. And that's something that I feel very strongly about. And if I could get the medical profession to bring in something like our training into their you know, patient flow, and have our help incorporated into the healthcare journey for these patients, that would be a huge shift in and of itself. I can't even talk about social media and body image and all of that. You know, that's beyond, I just don't know what's going to happen there. But every single individual health coach, every single person who has had an experience, every single one of us who's speaking up, speaking out and sharing helpful evidence-based content about, you know, what true health looks like, that's how we can contribute in our little corner of the world on that massive problem that is image and appearance and social media and lunatics on the internet who haven't a clue what they're talking about.
And that's why I have the podcast, in short. That's why I do the podcast. And I also love podcasting because of the long form nature of it. Yeah. So it's not 15 or 30 seconds clipped into meme. It's the ability for to discuss nuance and for context, and why I like to have individuals like yourself on the platform who can, you know, completely free. It's accessible. Anyone can find and listen to a podcast. Don't know if there are, you know, many people in the Western world that don't have an iPhone. And, you know, that's why we do what we do here. And I'll say a huge thank you to you for joining us on this episode and for contributing and for spreading your message and adding your voice. Every time that we do a podcast or a topic or a theme comes up that is discussed multiple times and reinforced, for me, it's layers and layers and layers of individuals speaking, you know, towards a similar goal or a similar outcome. And that's really what we want to do here. So I'll say a huge thank you to you for joining us. And if people want to find out more about you and the work you do, where are the best places to find you and connect with you if they have any questions or want to reach out?
Sure. So obviously our website, eatingfreely.com, straight away you're presented with either I'm an adult looking for support, or I'm a practitioner looking for training, and you just pick your box and off you go. Everything is there. We do everything from masterclasses right up to full professional training for professionals. And clients can access our network of practitioners or ask for support or send an email or whatever to find the help and support that they need at the level that will work for them. I'm also on LinkedIn, so professionals can reach out to me there. We're on Facebook, we're on YouTube, and I try and do a video. I try and completely fail actually to do a video once a week, but I probably get one out about every 3 weeks. But I am on YouTube doing videos, mainly for clients actually, and just help and support around, you know, dealing with emotional eating and binge eating. And we're on Instagram, we're on TikTok. So yeah, just look us up on any of the normal platforms. And I'm happy to hear from anybody who does have any questions or wants to be linked in with a practitioner or wants to inquire about training. So please feel free to reach out to me anytime. I'm sure, Caroline, you're going to make my contact details available at the end of the podcast. So
I'm going to put them all in the show notes, so it's super, super easy to find Emma. But Emma, thank you so much. And we'll thank you for appearing on the podcast and for all of the value today.
And thank you so much for having me, Caroline. I really appreciate it.
I want to say a huge thank you to Emma for her contribution this week on the Health Hacks podcast. I listened to the podcast back just to check the final edit before it goes out on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And this is one of the recordings that when I listened to it back, I actually did several times. There were so many layers to what Emma was saying. I took more and more from it every time that I listened to the episode. And I just want to say a huge thank you to her for her expertise and the work that she's done with Eating Freely. If you are an individual who wants to make a lasting change and improve their relationship with food, or perhaps you're a health professional looking for training, maybe you want to work closely with individuals in the emotional eating or binge eating space, go on the Eating Freely website. I've linked the details in the show notes below, and there are a ton of resources there. Emma's details are also there. And if you are listening to this and you're someone who has struggled with emotional eating, perhaps it feels like your entire life, and you feel that this is the time that you're ready to make a change, perhaps listening to this podcast episode was one of the first steps in that change, get in touch. Let's have a conversation about it. I know from the discussions I have with women worldwide that emotional eating is a huge barrier for a lot of women. They've dealt with and had a negative relationship with food. Sometimes it feels like their entire life, and it can really help to vocalize this and to speak to someone who has helped others navigate this journey. It is possible, and it can be for you too. Perhaps that just hasn't happened up until this point because you haven't had the support that you need. Okay, as ever, my details are in the show notes below. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Health Hacks podcast. We will be back next Tuesday. Have a wonderful week.